Don't start with me,
Blog
Joan.
Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
This is Fran Lewis, and I am praying to God that this works. Please listen to me up there. Phil Mullen is in here. And this is the third time. And this first two times, this sound didn't love me. And it better love me today, or I'm going to have a fit. Okay. Robin Lockwood is back, and her enemy, Maddie Kerrigan, is back. The novel resounds around two MMA fighters on opposite sides at first. Explain why Robin and Mandy, their similarities and differences, and how come they both have a short fuse, which is beginning to tell me I have a short one, too.
Well, Betrayal is my seventh Robin Lockwood book, and actually, it's my 27th novel overall, which I find pretty bizarre because I never thought I'd even write one novel, let alone have 27 published. But Robin is has been the star of my last seven books, and she's a really interesting character. Her background sort of sets up the story in Betrayal. She was raised in a small Midwestern town, and her father and her three brothers were all championship high school wrestlers. And so when she got to high school, she wanted to wrestle also. And when the parents of a lot of the boys on the team found out that a girl was going to wrestle, they went ballistic and went to the school board to try to get the school board to forbid Robin to join the boys' wrestling team. And they succeeded. The school board said, you can't wrestle. Well, Robin's family are all fighters, and her dad hired a lawyer, and they sued the school board, and they won. And that's when Robin decided that when she grew up, she was going to be a lawyer. Well, she got on the boys' wrestling team and actually does pretty well. By her senior year, she places third in the district championship, and it's the first time a girl has ever done something like that. But then she goes to a college that has a Division I wrestling team, and she realizes there's no way that she could ever make that team. Everyone's, you know, a national title contender. So, but she still likes combat sports, so she finds a local gym and starts practicing mixed martial arts. When Betrayal opens, it's 10 years before the main action in the book. And Robin's also a brilliant student. She's a physics major, and because of her academic record, she's able to get into Yale Law School, but she's also ranked seventh nationally in mixed martial arts in the UFC. So she has a fight scheduled on a card in Las Vegas on pay-per-view television, and that's how she pays her tuition to Yale Law School, is with the money she's making in mixed martial arts fights. Well, right when the book starts, again, like I said, it's 10 years before the main action, her manager comes to her and says that the top fight, or one of the top fights on the fight card, is between Mandy Kerrigan and another fighter. Mandy's ranked number two in the weight class, and the winner of this fight between Mandy and this other combatant is going to get a shot at the world title. Well, the person that Mandy's supposed to fight breaks her ankle, and they're looking for someone to fill in, and so they don't have to cancel that fight. And since Robin is ranked nationally, they ask her if she'll step in. Her manager says don't do it because he's very realistic about her chances. Mm. And he says, look, you're good, but Mandy's way out of your class. But Robin says, you know, once I'm done with law school, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm not going to fight anymore. And this is my only chance to maybe get a world title fight. So she takes the fight and gets clobbered and knocked out. She has short-term memory loss, and this convinces her to end her fighting career right then and there. Now, 10 years later, when the main, like I said, the main action in the book, Betrayal, begins, Mandy Kerrigan's career is on the downside. And she did win a world title. She was the top dog for a while, but then injuries shortened her career, or as career as a world champion. And now when the book starts, she's at the downside of her career. She's the person who other up-and-coming fighters fight so they can put on their resume that they beat a former world champ. So, but at this point in time, Robin is a extremely successful lawyer, and the two of them meet when Mandy is arrested for a quadruple homicide.
Yeah, well, she killed the Finch family, supposedly, and there's a whole bunch of them that she got involved with, and one specifically, one Ryan, for no reason. So why does someone like Mandy, Margaret Finch is no good, and Ryan is no good, and Annie's no good, and the father is no good, and they're all no good. So why would she get involved with drugs and stuff like that? And why would she get close to Ryan when she knows very well it could make her even worse than she was before?
Well, this happens, unfortunately. A lot of athletes do extremely well, and then injuries and other aging affect their career. And Mandy, the only thing she has going for her is fighting. She has no other skills. And so she started taking performance-enhancing drugs to help her when she has these fights. And the Finch family, Ryan is the 21-year-old son. They are all awful people. And just to go back a little bit, to give you a little bit of background on the Finch family, the way I got the idea for the book, and ideas are the. For me, writing is pretty easy. I have no problem writing. I can sit down and just do it. But getting an idea that's complicated enough to fill up a 400-page book is something that I find very difficult. Fortunately, I only have to get one idea a year because I usually have one book a year come out. And so the way I got the idea for this book revolves around the Finch family. Usually in a murder mystery, there's one person murdered, and the detective or the lawyer or whoever is the main character has to figure out who done it. But I said, well, what if you had an entire family murdered, and every single person in the family is an awful human being? So the gimmick in Betrayal is that you not only have to figure out who done it, but who was the intended victim. And the Finches, just to introduce you to them, Margaret is the mother, and she is the lawyer for the Russian mob. And she's just, you know, representing some of the worst criminals. Her husband, Nathan, is a brilliant chemist, but he just got fired from his job at a pharmaceutical company for embezzling money And the reason he embezzled the money was to pay off bookies. He's got a gambling habit, and these bookies are really vicious. They'd have no problem killing you. In order to make the money to pay the bookies off, he's making designer drugs and having his 21-year-old son sell the drugs. So the son is a drug dealer. And then Annie, and I won't tell you what happens with her, but she looks like initially like she's the only decent person in the family, but it turns out that she has a very dark side to her. So each one of the Finches has different people who are capable of murder and who would really like to kill him. So you have to figure out, once you can figure out, and once Robin Lockwood can figure out who the intended victim was, then you can figure out who the killer is. But that's the hard part. So getting back to Ryan's relationship to Mandy Kerrigan, Ryan sells Mandy performance-enhancing drugs before her fight in Portland. It turns out that she's on a fight card in Portland, and this is, again, like I said, on the downside of her career. And Robin goes to see the fight because Mandy's the person who ended her career and made her realize that she would have a better future as a lawyer. So when Mandy loses her fight, the worst thing possible happens. It turns out that she flunks a drug test. And Ryan is guaranteed that no one can trace these drugs. But the drug test turns up that performance-enhancing drugs in her system. So she is in danger of being suspended, and which means that she won't be able to earn a living. And in addition, her purse is going to be held up. And that means she won't have any the money that she's been counting on to live. So she has a real motive to kill Ryan, and in fact beats him up when she learns about the failed drug test.
That is horrible. But let's get to the good stuff, people, because I'm not going to tell you if I figured it out. Everybody knows I read too much and figure out too much sometimes and get in trouble.
You can't tell who's done it, though.
No, I wouldn't tell them, nope. But I will tell them this, that, you know, Robin had a point, and so did Mandy, for wanting to fight. And when I was in high school, I was 5 feet 12, 200 pounds, because I'm 100 now, and I made the girls and guys basketball team. They actually wanted me to play. Yeah, despite the fact that I'm little, I could do a three-pointer, and I don't know how I did it. But I'll tell you what, it was the most fun time I had ever. My mother didn't want me to play. I go, like, don't worry about it. I can handle this. So you'd be surprised. You know, little people can do an awful lot. Just, what can I say? So let's get to the good part. The little bit of controversy here, because we have Tom McGee, she gets arrested for murder, right? And they want to kill her, poor Mandy. So we have Tom McGee and Robin, and they're going to go up against each other, but they're dating. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I in some of the earlier books, Robin has a fiancé, and he died.
I know.
And so she's really grieving in a lot of the books, and has not. She's tried dating, and she hasn't been able to find anyone that she wants to go out with more than once. And then she has had a couple of cases with Tom, who is a district attorney. And they meet at a bar function, and he knows that she works out every day. It's sort of common knowledge that even though she's not a professional fighter anymore, she still goes to the gym every morning and works out, so she's in great shape. And he's a training for a marathon. He's very athletic, too. And so at this bar function, he asks Robin if she'd like to run with him. And things develop where a romance starts. But then Mandy is arrested and charged with aggravated murder, four aggravated murder charges for killing the entire Finch family. The police think that she's the murderer. And this carries a possible death sentence. So Oregon has the death penalty, even though in reality right now there's sort of a moratorium on it. But for the sake of my book, they're still charging death penalty. And so Mandy has been arrested, charged with death penalty, Robin has been appointed to represent her. But then she finds out that Tom is going to be the lawyer on the other side. And I set that up because I thought it'd be really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
This actually does happen in real life where husband and wife or two people who are romantically involved end up on both sides of a law case, and there's ethical moral problems involved. So I thought it'd be fun for the reader to try to see how these two young lovers work out their romantic relationship while they're on either side of a very serious murder case.
You can't kill him off, though, because I cried the first time. Oh, I was like, oh, my God, how could you do this, poor Robin? And he was great. So I said, you can't kill him off, because otherwise they're going to be very unhappy people. That's just my point of view, people. Okay, now we've
truth. I've had a couple of fans write me with the same emotional reaction.
Yeah.
So it's actually, as a writer, you're always trying to evoke emotion. And
yeah,
when
I know.
You can do it, it's great. So I always feel good if I get some sort of a violent reaction from a reader about something that I did in the book. So it's fun for me because it means whatever I did is really working.
It is. It's very upsetting, though, people, psyche here. So you've got the other character that I read about, Amanda Jaffe. You don't mess with her either. And we have Ken the investigator. But you told me a long time ago that in order to run a death penalty case, you need a second person, right? A second person has to do this, right? So I got that. Not bad. So who is Ken, and what role does Amanda play? Basically, Robin takes the lead, but what does he do? And he's pretty good, too, so far.
So for anyone listening in who doesn't know about my background, before I became a writer, I was a criminal defense lawyer for 25 years. And when I was in the seventh grade, as a result of reading too many Perry Mason novels, I decided that when I grew up, I wanted to be a criminal defense lawyer and do murder cases. And that was really the only thing I ever wanted to do. And for 25 years, starting in the 1970s, I had a really exciting career as a criminal defense lawyer. I did 30 homicide cases, including 12 death penalty cases. I got to argue in the U.S. Supreme Court. And so I did a lot of death cases. And the death penalty case is really different from any other case, even a regular murder case. Murder trial runs pretty much exactly like any other shoplifting or whatever. You just the charge is more serious, but the way the trial works is pretty similar. District attorney puts on evidence. Jury, the defense may or may not put on evidence. And then the jury just makes a decision on whether or not the person's guilty. If they find the person not guilty, the case is over. If they find them guilty, then a judge makes a decision on what sentence to impose. In a death penalty case, it's very, very different. The jury that decides that the person is guilty has to immediately have a second trial on what sentence is going to be imposed. And this sentencing hearing has to happen immediately because you don't want the jury sitting out for like a month. So, like going back, in a normal case, let's say you're found guilty on January 1st, there's probably going to be a month to 2 months before you come back in and the judge decides your sentence. And during that time, the defense attorney will try to get evidence that would suggest you should have a weaker sentence. There's a probation officer who writes a report for the judge. The district attorney will try to get people. So there's a big gap, but there's probably only a 1 or 2 day gap in a death penalty case because you don't want the jurors influenced by reading a newspaper or having people talk to them about what they think the sentence should be. So they come back immediately. Ken is the investigator that Robin has. And he has a sort of interesting background, former CIA, police officer, et cetera. And when you're doing a death penalty case, you really have to, the lawyer has to assume the worst. And you really prepare for the two different trials immediately. So you assume your client's going to be convicted, even if you think you have a good chance of getting acquittal. And you then have investigators not only trying to figure out if there's a way to show that your client's innocent, but also preparing for the sentencing phase by humanizing any witnesses like psychiatrists or people who know the defendant from the time he was born. You have to humanize your client because once the client's found guilty, then all the juror knows is that this person committed a terrible act. He killed somebody. And so they have a very negative opinion. And a lot of times the person has had a really horrible upbringing, the defendant. Mm. And so you want to explain to the jurors, yeah, he did something really awful, but here's what his life was like. And you try to let the jury know that even though he's done something very bad, he shouldn't be executed because there's, you know, his life, there's things that happened in his life that might have made the jurors become a terrible person too if they'd gone through it. So your investigator is absolutely essential. Another reason you have to have an investigator, and this is every case, I sort of found this out when I was a young lawyer, much to my surprise, but a lawyer cannot testify as a witness for his client.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you have a client who's charged with robbery, and you go to the victim without an investigator. Just you're the lawyer. You just walk up and you talk to the victim, and you say, "What did the robber look like?" And your client is a 6 foot Caucasian. And the victim says, well, he was a 5 foot Chinese man. So you think, wow, I've got this, you know, sure winner. And then you get into court and the witness gets on the stand. The DA says, what did the robber look like? And he points at your client, just like him, 6 foot white man. Well, you're not allowed to get on the stand and testify that just a 2 weeks ago, he said it was a 5 foot tall Chinese man.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to have an investigator with you whenever you talk to a witness, or even if you're not involved, you just have the investigator go out because the investigator could testify. So if you'd had an investigator with you, you would then put him on the stand when it was a defense hearing and say, you know, did you talk to the victim a week ago? Yes, I did. And how did he describe the person who robbed him? Well, he said he was a 5-foot Chinese man. So you can do that if an investigator is along, or if someone other than the lawyer does the interview. So Robin has to have an investigator, and in this case, of course, it's 10. Now, there's another rule in the death penalty case that you can't just try it by yourself. You have to have a second lawyer, and it's an ethical requirement because the case, the death case, is so serious. You know, if you lose any other case, it's an indeterminate, you know, it's a sentence, but it's not a sentence that can't be changed. Death penalty, you can't change it. If the guy gets executed and then new evidence pops up, you can't say, oops, sorry. So in Oregon, the requirement is that you have to have a second lawyer, and that's really good because obviously every lawyer is going to try to make the decision that he thinks is the best, but it's really important that you have someone who can say, you know, Phil, you think this idea is pretty good, but I don't think it is, and here's why. So a sounding board, someone to bounce ideas off. You know, actually, being a criminal defense lawyer it really helps when you're editing a book. You know, it's really just, you know, when you're doing a death penalty case, you have your second chair who can tell you where you screwed up. And that's really the job of an editor when I send my manuscript into Keith Taylor in New York at St. Martin's, thinking, wow, this is really terrific. You need someone to say, well, Phil, I know you think it's terrific, but here's the problem, and here's the problem, and here's the problem. So it's the same mindset writing a novel and trying a murder case. You need somebody to come in and show you where you screwed up. And in this case, I bring back Amanda Jaffe. Now, I have had three series. One is with Dana Cutler. That was my Washington trilogy, Executive Privilege, Supreme Justice, and Capital Murder. And that was, I have four books in that series, also Sleight of Hand. But then I have five books in the Amanda and Frank Jaffe series. And that was a really popular series that I did. And when I started doing the Robin Lockwood series, I've had these trials, a couple of death penalty cases in a few of the books. And, of course, Robin needs a second chair. And I thought it'd be fun because Amanda was a pretty popular character to bring her in as second chair. So in Betrayal, Robin asked Amanda if she would be second chair in Mandy's murder case.
So what happens in a regular case, I'm not going to say what kind, why don't all lawyers have an investigator to find out if the person that is doing the other side or the person that actually did something wrong to find out if they have any other cases against them? And I think that's something I'm not going to say why. It's been bothering me for a very long time. So I said, if this person has one case against them, how many more? Why wouldn't you investigate to find out so that you could win? And they don't.
Well, no, most attorneys have investigators do the work for them. Like, as I explained, if you do it on your own, anything that you might find out. First of all, you know, there's so many parts to a criminal trial. One has to do with the facts. You know, what actually happened, and that's where you need an investigator to go out and talk to witnesses. look at the scene. I have had a couple of murder cases that I won just by going to the scene of the crime. Judging distances, how far apart were certain things, where were certain things located. And so you need an investigator to do things like that, to go out and talk to the people in the neighborhood, people who witnessed the event. And that's best left up to somebody with a background. A lot of the investigators have a police background or some type of law enforcement background. But there's the other parts are the legal stuff, the rules of evidence and motions to suppress. And that's what you're trained to do in law school. And so it's a division of labor. So you sit down with your investigator and say, I'm going to work on a motion to suppress and on jury instructions and other stuff that I was trained for in law school. You go out and interview witnesses, take photographs of the accident scene, et cetera, stuff that you were trained to do as a police officer or, whatever your background is for your as an investigator. So it's the only time that you wouldn't be able to do that is if it's financial, because you have to hire an investigator. Now, if you're a big firm, you probably have an in-house investigator. If you're not a big firm, if you're a sole practitioner, then you're going to have to hire an investigator to work on your case. And sometimes it's not worth the outlay of money. For instance, if a client comes in and says, I was just arrested for shoplifting, shoplifting some lipstick or, a magazine or something. Well, you know that if the person's convicted, nothing's going to happen to them. And so the question is, you're going to charge your client X amount of money to be the lawyer. Is it financially worthwhile to also ask them for the money that they need to hire an investigator? So it's a monetary decision in a lot of cases. Like I said, big firms always have an investigator or one or more, if they're a really big firm, working just in-house. But if you're a sole practitioner, it's a financial decision. But in a death case, you absolutely have to have an investigator, and sometimes more than one.
Okay, now, before I forget, on Monday, no, it's Tuesday, actually, December 5th, the author of Least We Forget. On the 7th, we're going to have a little fun. Elves for a Day, a children's book by Deb Hockenberry. Children need to know how to help other people. On the 12th, the author of The Legacy. On the 14th, I'm going to brave this one. It's a panel, and it's going to be on ageism. The 6 questions that when people ask me, I want to hang up, and I won't answer them. Age questions that are insulting. Yeah, you have no idea. I got on the phone with someone this morning, and she asked me my date of birth, and I said, it's probably in the phone book, and I don't remember where I put it. And then she said, but you have to tell it to me. I said, you would think after coming to this person for 20 years, you could figure that out, and I refuse to tell her. It's annoying. And then they talk to you like you're 105, so forget that. On the 18th, we have Michelle Cameron, and on the 20th, what better way to end December than with the greatest horror writer in the world, Vincent Zandri, and Moonlight Falcon. And his book I read in an hour, not even, and his character is outrageous. So that's what's coming, and we're starting in January with New York Times author Dick Belsky and Broadcast Blues. And this girl is booked until the end of February. So if you have anything out there, March is getting crowded too, believe it or not. And I was so honored the other day. I don't know if you know who he is. I didn't even know he knew who I am. He is the chief federal judge of the Trade Commission. The former chief federal judge of the Trade Commission, Stephen Granger. And he's coming on in January, and I go like, Oh, my God. I had no idea. So I'm getting very popular. So, and then I told everybody that you were coming on. So now we've got the question of the day. Mandy has to be in jail, right, for a while? How does she deal with that? Because she's not exactly the calmest person in the world.
Well, two things happen. First of all, being in jail, one of the problems is, you know, especially if you're a if the word gets around that you're a professional fighter, somebody's going to want to test you. And she does quite well because she does get, Robin asks her how she's doing in jail, and she says, you know, that this person did try to pick a fight with her, but she beat her up pretty badly, and that gave her a lot of credibility with the other prisoners.
Good for her.
But what also happens, and I won't tell you what the background is because it would spoil some of the fun, but Robin, and one of the, going back to when I was creating the character, in about probably more than half of my books, I have very strong women characters, and they frequently will get into dangerous situations. And in real life, if a man and a woman fight, then the man's probably going to win. Just he has bigger upper body strength, probably has done some kind of combat sport at some point in his life, like boxing, wrestling. So I was trying to figure out if Robin, how can I make it realistic if I had a character like Robin who gets in a fight with a man? I said, oh, I'll make him a professional fighter. So that's why I got her to be a ranked MMA fighter, so that if she does get into a fight with a male, which happens in a couple of the books, and she wins, the reader's not going to say, oh, well, that's ridiculous. You know, this is, you know, silly. They'll say, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So something happens in the book. It's an action sequence that where Robin does get into a fight, and it's something that becomes publicized. So the fact that Mandy's got Robin as her lawyer gives her even more credibility in prison. Robin becomes sort of a celebrity, and that makes Mandy a celebrity because Robin's her lawyer. So she actually is able to handle the jail fairly well.
Now, there's one character who I left out his name for a reason, because otherwise we'll figure out who the person was that whatever they did. So how did you create the one moment that led Robin to realize, oh, my God, and how does she get stressed out? Because this could really make her a nervous wreck just to deal with this.
Well, I'm trying to think of a way of answering your question without giving away, you know, what the biggest thing in the mystery is,
we don't
want to
tell anybody,
who done it. Actually, I have a funny story about that. I've had two writing careers. In my 30s, I wrote, I had two books published. Heartstone was my first novel. That was published in 1978. And then 1981, my second novel, The Last Innocent Man, was published. And then I quit for 12 years because the same year that I had the book published, I argued at the U.S. Supreme Court and started, in between the two books, started getting hired to do big murder cases and appeals, which is what I always wanted to do since I was a kid. But one incident that happened when I was, when my second book, The Last Innocent Man, was published, I did a lot of TV. Television, and I was interviewed in Portland by someone who had never interviewed a fiction writer before. And during the interview, he said, you know, how come you made X the killer? And, of course, that's the worst possible thing that could happen to a mystery story writer, is on
television. That's horrible.
Having the person, you know, having the interviewer give away who the killer is. So I gave some sort of a fumbling answer that I hope would be so confusing that no one would ever would stop thinking about that. And then as soon as the cameras stopped, they took a break for a commercial. The guy came up to me and he apologized. He says, "Oh my God." He says, "As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I realized what I'd done." He says, "You're the first fiction writer that I've ever interviewed." And he was very apologetic. And I said, "Don't worry about it." And the book sales were pretty good. So it obviously didn't hurt the book sales at all. So whenever I'm interviewed, I remember that situation. So getting back to your question, I'm trying to think of. So what I've done in a number of my books is when the hero or heroine, in this case Robin, is in a situation where things are going really badly and it looks like she's going to lose her case. Some of the times what I do is I have them have a dream. And in the dream, things happen which don't seem to make any sense, but which when she wakes up, she says, "Oh my God, I didn't see this coming." And so that's what I do in the book. She has things are going really horribly in her trial with Mandy. And then she is stressed out, has a really bad night sleeping. And then in her dream, her brain sort of shuffles things around and gets her thinking about something that happened that lets her figure out who the real killer is. So it's really interesting. I get a lot of my ideas for books when I'm sleeping. I don't know if other authors that you have on your show have this happen, but it's not unusual at all for me to wake up when I'm working on a book and say, "Oh, I could do this, this, and this." Or right before I go to bed, I'll be lying down trying to get to sleep, and then an idea will pop in, and then I jump up and I send myself an email with the idea so that in the morning I don't forget about it.
I wish I could do that. You see, but I have an advantage, people. Everybody I write about is dead. And they're either guilty, and they're telling their story, so it doesn't matter if there's a jury. I mean, yeah, I'm very excited to say, I just found out that I don't know if I'm going to write another one ever again, but this one's going to be called Mirror Image, and then that's part one, and then The Dead Returned, part two. Mirror Image means that you look at your face in the mirror, and what you see is a distorted face. If you don't undo what you've done to someone else, you're going to wind up that face in the mirror. And don't ask me how I thought of that. I don't know. But I thought it was different. And it's going to come out in January. And hopefully people will want to read it. There are 8 stories. They're all different. And everybody is guilty. And they have to decide if they want to repent. Yeah, it's scary. And the second part is the part of my book that I wrote, Silent Voices. People whose voices were silenced and need to be heard. And 5 of them are true. So everybody's got to figure out which ones. Okay, now, the fun part. Here we go. My paper's turned. What about, I know the ending, and I know the verdict, and I know what happened, so we're not going to tell anybody and go like, what? So what about Robin and Tom? Are they going to stay together? What's next for these two? Because you can't kill him off, not yet anyway. You can't, no, can't have that.
Well, I'm going to take a break after 7 Robin Lockwood.
Can't do that.
I'm just taking a little break from the series. And I've got a really fun book that is finished. It's my 28th. It's tentatively called An Insignificant Case. With my editor in New York, and I should be getting the edits back sometime next month. but it was sort of inspired by a real case that I had when I was just starting out. It's been back in the 1970s, and I was hired, or I court appointed at that point. I had a really small practice, so I tried to build it up, and I was court appointed to represent an artist who had a dispute with a restaurant that bought one of his paintings, and so he broke in to the restaurant and stole the painting back. And so I represented him. It was a little nothing case. So in the book that is being edited, and that it'll come out probably next November, 2024, I have a lawyer who's not very successful, Charlie Webb. I described him. I said if Charlie was a grade, he would be a C, because he's not awful, but he really doesn't do anything that well. And his practice is just starting out. It's really not doing great. And he is appointed by the court to represent this mathematical genius who had a nervous breakdown and who believes that he is the reincarnation of a painter who worked in the Renaissance with Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. And so he's a little crazy. And he goes around dressed almost like Jesus. He looks like he's big. He's like 6'4", but he wears this outfit that makes him look like Jesus Christ. And he's got a beard and, you know, he's long hair. And he is actually a very good artist. And so he goes from restaurant to restaurant to sell his paintings, and they're good, so they get bought. But he's nuts, and if he doesn't like where the painting is displayed, he breaks in at night and liberates the painting. And of course, he gets arrested. But he claims, you know, that it's his right to do this because they didn't hang the painting where he wanted them to. So the incident, which appears initially to be a big nothing, he breaks into this Italian restaurant and steals back a painting of Venice that he did. But he also takes something out of a safe, and it's a thumb drive that shows has a snuff film on it. And the person that owns the restaurant and this movie producer whose picture has been nominated for an Oscar are arrested for running a sex trafficking ring. And this snuff film plus the list of all the people who could be, you know, famous politicians, et cetera, businessmen who are on this, identified as the clients. Everyone's out trying to kill the clients so they can get this thumb drive back. So it's sort of a fun. I had a lot of fun with the book because it starts out as an insignificant case, something that looks like it's a big nothing, and balloons into this big case. So I had a lot of fun writing it. Like I said, I got the idea from this little case that I had years and years ago.
That's interesting. I know that my book, Sisters, Two Sisters from the Bronx, are based on stuff that happened when I was teaching and when I was with my sister. But to be able to come up with an idea in the middle of the night is amazing. I think the hardest thing for me is when I have to figure out how to start a book review and make people want to read it, because my reviews are different. And no, I had the beginning of it, like the beginning of a chapter. Well, if the first three sentences don't grab me, then obviously the book didn't grab me either, which is amazing. And unfortunately, I have to say this is really upsetting. Amazon, somebody hacked into my Amazon account, and I can't write any reviews. I have spoken to 25 people, and they don't seem to get it. I've never written anything derogatory. I've never written a bad review. But somebody, for some reason, wrote something, and now they're not letting me write a review. So I posted everywhere else. And I did speak to the people in charge, and I don't know how to fix it. I don't know what to do.
So so you had someone write a review on Amazon claiming
somebody
it was
wrote
you.
Something. Somebody changed one of my reviews or added something. And now when I want to post a review, it says, "We're very sorry, but there's been unusual activity on this account, but it's not my account." And I said to the, I called them. Like, talking to them is like talking to an arm with no fingers. Seriously, I have no clue. I mean, it's insulting, and I did send one this morning and said, "It would be nice if you could fix it, but you know what? It's your loss, because when I write a review, your sales double." So, where can everybody get every one of your series? And this sounds like a new character, and I hope I get it before everybody else does.
Yeah, like I said, I'm waiting to get beat up by my editor. I actually encouraged my editors. I only had one writing course in my whole life, and I got a C-plus creative writing when I was in college. So I haven't taken any of the writing classes, so I always encourage my editors to beat me up. You know, I tell them, please don't tell me anything you like about the book, because if you like it, it's working. Tell me where I screwed up so that, you know, we can make the book better. So I am waiting to get the edits back, because I'm really curious. I'm always curious to see what the editor thinks about it. But all of my books are, like, anywhere you can get books, you can get it. They're on, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You know, you can get the e-books, or you can buy the hardcovers or whatever. They're audio. All the books are on audio and big print, and, you know, any place that you can buy a book, you can get Betrayal or any of the other books I've written.
Well, all of them are fantastic, and I don't buy anything on Amazon. People don't send me the book, I'm not going to read it. Not anymore, what can I say? But for those of you that don't know, before I retired, and if my mother didn't have Alzheimer's, I'd probably still be there. I'm a reading and writing specialist, and I try to take reading and writing in college for my fourth master's, for real. So I got pretty good at it, and I tried. And my students obviously are writing, which is fantastic. Some of them are authors, actually. And they're on Facebook, and they tell me that, because of me, they even learn to read. But, Phil, thank God the sound worked this time. And if you ever have time to do a panel, let me know. And everybody, if you don't like those six questions that people ask you, starting with what's your date of birth, I forgot, you should listen on December 14th at 10, because you might get a little bit of an insight. Everybody, it's a beautiful day. Thank God, Phil, it worked. This has been so much fun. Everybody have a great day, and bye.